Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
Welcome to Room 101. This time we are watching the 1954 BBC adaptation of George Orwell's 1984.
Remember what I say? I am speaking the truth. I call upon the people to follow me. Follow me. Follow me. Or die.
You save us! You help us!
We are protectors!
Beep, 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 beep.
This was adapted for television by Nigel Neal, directed by Rudolf Cartier from the 1949 novel by George Orwell, and it stars Peter Cushing as Winston Smith. There's a lot to say about this, so before we go any further, we're going to have a gin. It's time to get out the tonic screwdriver and open up the bottle. This time, we are drinking Isle of Wight Distillery HMS Victory Navy Strength Gin. It is 57%. And the info bollock says, the Isle of Wight Distillery has partnered with the National Museum of the Royal Navy to distill a Navy Strength gin named after HMS Victory, the Navy's most illustrious warship, and a percentage of all sales go to support their ongoing restoration. Launched in 1765, she is the oldest commissioned warship in the world. Admiral Lord Nelson, aside from being a national hero, commanding the fleet from the HMS Victory during the Battle of Trafalgar, famous for his naval victories and tactics, was also a gin lover. And quite particular about his choice of tipple. This original mix, Navy Strength Gin, has a higher concentration of botanicals, giving a more intense flavour and aroma. In the 18th century, the Royal Navy legislated that all naval ships were to carry a quantity of gin on board, and that it must be 100% proof, the English standard of the day, which equates to 57% ABV. It was discovered that gunpowder soaked in alcohol with a strength of more than 57% could still be ignited, and this became the standard test for Navy strength or gunpowder-proof gin. Ship's gin was stored in oak barrels, which over time imparted its distinctive colour and flavour. Well, it doesn't tell us anything about the gin, but it's a nice little history lesson. Dr. Exton, we have louche.
We do.
What's the nasal appraisal?
It smells like gin.
Gin. Oh, well, eyes down, dive in. We're just drinking this with tonic and ice. Boom.
Oh, yes.
That's a rather lovely kick to it, hasn't it?
That hits the spot very nicely.
Now, I'm very, very fond of Navy Strength gins. The ones that we've had, you get sort of... some of them, well, obviously 57% is the benchmark, but we've had some in the 50s before, and they've all been bloody good. In fact, I don't think we've disliked one that's been Navy strength or industrial strength, have we?
No, we haven't. And just to say, we're doing this one because of the name, really.
Yes.
And we're doing 1984, in which has Victory Gin in it, and this is the closest we could find to Victory Gin, HMS Victory Gin.
Well,
I'm bloody glad we're doing it.
I'm going to say, you've picked a good one. There's not a lot to say about it. It's a very ginny gin. All Navy strength gins, they have a very similar taste. You get to this level, they're all much of a muchness.
Yeah, any subtle botanicals would be completely knocked out of the park by this. This is gin that doesn't pretend to be anything other than gin and bloody good at it.
Yeah.
I am gin, here I stand, and doing it pretty well. 5 out of 5.
5 out of 5 for me as well. Yeah, I really like these strong ones. And it's not because I'm a closet alcoholic. It's because they're just...
Closets here.
No closets. We're all out of those. But it's just a really, really nice drink. Yes. HMS Victory, Isle of Wight Distillery. Go and buy a bottle.
In your eye. Well, actually, if you're drinking it in your eye, you've missed.
Grab your glasses. Let's descend into the under gallery at Podcasting House. We're opening up the Black Archive. The repository of all lost film and TV. It's time to dig stuff out. What are you rescuing this week?
I'm going to cop out slightly, but only slightly, in that the thing that I'm going to rescue is the missing episodes of the play strand that 1984 was produced in.
Okay.
And we tend to do this as a default. So that is the BBC Sunday Night Theatre, which was an absolute staple in the 1950s. We've already rescued one from the Black Archive when we talked about Arrow to the Heart. So as a default, I'd like to rescue this play strand. But as I say, defaults are a cop-out. So I'm also going to rescue the play strand in which the other BBC adaptation of 1984 was produced, the 1960s version that starred Jane Merrow, and that was Theatre 625.
Not familiar with this work. Tell me more. Well, I'm going to take a wild guess that it was called Theatre 625 because it was the transfer to the new TV format.
And Dunning Colour, another famous play in there called No Trams to Lime Street, Unman, Wittering and Zygo. And again, it was part of the British television tradition in the sort of 50s and 60s and tailing off in the 70s and finally in the 80s of theatrical presentations on telly.
I don't know whether it's a television form that could, stroke, should be brought back. It was because we've had a few of these streams recently where it's spun off into series, notably Callan.
Well, the National Theatre are doing things like that in that they have sort of streamable and watchable recordings of some of their productions. And occasionally these will get theatrical releases. I went to see Frankenstein when Benedict Cumberbatch was in it as a cinema presentation of the theatre. Yeah, and it was brilliant. He was absolutely superb. It's when it was a two-parter, and he and Johnny Lee Miller, one played Frankenstein, one played the monster, and they swapped roles every night.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so Cumberbatch would be Frankenstein one night and the monster the next night, same with Johnny Lee Miller. I saw it with Cumberbatch as Frankenstein, Johnny Lee Miller as the monster. It was spellbinding. Was such a good piece of theatre, and I've lost track of the fact that I was watching it on the big screen rather than and I was watching it live because it was a live
feed.
Yeah, but it was amazing, and you really got the feel of the theatre. So I think theatre on television can be done. I think to do it now, you would have to really recreate that live theatre experience. And I think the live nature of TV as it was in the 50s, as it pretty much was in the 60s, really lends itself well to that theatrical experience.
Okay, well, I'm going to rescue the 1965 series Sherlock Holmes. This was broadcast over two series in 1965 and 1968. The first series starred Douglas Wilmer, 1964 to 1965. The second series starred Peter Cushing as Sherlock Holmes, and Nigel Stock was in both of them as Dr. Watson. The first series starring Douglas Wilmer is largely intact. There are two episodes missing, although they have been reconstructed by the BFI. The second reel of one episode exists, the first reel of one episode exists, but Douglas Wilmer had recorded test readings to camera, so the BFI have reconstructed it using those readings. The second series with Peter Cushing, which is the one, I've got to be honest, I'm really interested in. He is my all-time favourite Sherlock Holmes. Only six of the 16 survive, and they are wonderful. He is Sherlock Holmes, how I had in my head when I read the books, and when I saw the episodes many, many years later, he's absolutely perfect. So that is the one. Fragments were discovered in the early 2020s of a couple of episodes, but there's still 10 episodes fully missing from that second series. I want them back.
Okay, were they sensor clips that were discovered?
I don't know is the honest answer. They've just got the fragments, so possibly. There's no more detail that I can find. So, it's on with the motley. We're watching the BFI Blu-ray release of 1984 from 1954. This is only 1 year after Quatermass, and this version, it caused a bit of controversy. We have got, I'm just going to skim through the Wikipedia entry for this because there is some really interesting background to this one.
It ended up with questions in Parliament.
It did, on its original broadcast, because it was broadcast live.
Isn't there a story Neil and Cartier had bodyguards assigned because there was a worry that they might get assaulted because of the intensity of the play?
The reaction section on Wikipedia, the play provokes something of an upset. There were complaints of horrific content, particularly the Room 101 scene, and the subversive nature of the play. There was also a report in the Daily Express newspaper of 42-year-old Beryl Murfin of Herne Bay collapsing and dying as she watched the production, under the headline, "Wife Dies as She Watches," allegedly from the shock of what she'd seen. I don't really want to go too far into this before we've actually seen the thing, because there looks like a lot of stuff on here that needs to be put in context. So I'm just going to pause this bit here and run VT on the plate. Like I say, we're watching the 2022 BFI Blu-ray release of this. I'm really looking forward to it because it's one of the earliest surviving examples of telerecorded TV. In fact, I think it's only the second telerecording of British television that exists.
There's at least two before this, because there's Quatermass experiment.
Well, yes, as one thing, there's Quatermass. But is there anything earlier than that?
Is it Midnight Dr. Schweitzer, which is another Cartier-directed play, starred André Morel and Reginald Tate. It was working on that production was the impetus behind André Morel being the initial choice for Quatermass for the Quatermass experiment.
Ah, right.
And then Reginald Tate being the one who was offered it. And that survives in its entirety. And we can do that on a future episode.
I think we can probably slot that in. But yes, before we spoil this too far, it's Ron VT on 1984 from 1954. Let's see what it's like.
Shall I say it? Or will you?
I will say it. We have come here because we believe there is some sort of organization working against the party and that you are involved in it.
We want to belong to it.
We are enemies of the party. We disbelieve in the principles of INGSOC. We are thought criminals. We want to put ourselves at your mercy. If that isn't sufficient...
Martin is one of us. Bring a chair for yourself. You can stop being a servant now. We'll sit down and talk in comfort. This is called wine. You will have read about it in books, no doubt.
Right, well, that was quite a powerful piece of television, wasn't it?
It was. It must have been absolutely gobsmacking at the time that it first came out.
For those of you unfamiliar with 1984...
Go and read it.
I don't really want to give too much away because it's plot-wise, it's reasonably thin. It's more painting a picture of a dystopian future.
Yeah. And I'm when I say go and read it, I'm not being... Well, I suppose I am being dismissive. But it's not just I can't be bothered to tell you what the plot is. It is such a good book.
Yeah.
It's one of those that if you read anything, you should read 1984. I don't personally think it's Orwell's best. I think Animal Farm is a better book.
Four legs good, two legs bad.
Exactly. But it's just one of those books that you should read. It was part of a whole series of excellent dystopian books that came out around about the same time, because there was Darkness at Noon. Okay, that was a couple of years earlier, but only a couple of years, because that was during the war, and 1984 is just after One, the David Carr book. Tells a similar story to 1984, but from a little bit more science fiction-y and from a less working class perspective.
Right.
But all excellent reads, all well worth reading. And the thing you need to know for our review is this is a dystopian, totalitarian future following a limited exchange of nuclear weaponry. As with many plays at the time, it had two transmissions. I'm not sure it was always intended to, because it was part of the Sunday Night Theatre strand.
It wasn't. Because it was transmitted on the 12th of December, Sunday 12th of December in 1954 at 8:30. It was then debated in Parliament because it was so strong. There were several early day motions put forward to just have a look at what the BBC was doing. It was suggested that they were pandering to sexual and sadistic tastes. So discussion within the BBC as to whether it deserved a second performance. And it was narrowly voted to perform it again on Thursday the 16th of December. So less
than
a week
later.
Which is a recording that we have. And it was preceded by a live introduction on camera by the head of drama, Michael Barry.
Which is available on the DVD as well.
It is, and it's quite lengthy. I mean, it goes on for a good few minutes. Frankly, watching the thing, I remember there being a warning on at least one of the Quatermass episodes.
That was Quatermass 2, which came after this.
That's true. But at the time, this would have been quite unpleasant, I think.
It's quite unpleasant now.
Yeah. There's certain elements in there.
And that's us being fairly tempered by a lot of the television that we've watched. I can understand why less than 10 years, we could call it immediately post-war.
Yeah.
And 1984 was published in...
49.
I'd remembered it as being pre-1948 because Orwell's original chosen title was 1948.
Oh, that I didn't know.
And he was pushed to change it to 1984 because it was felt to be a bit too raw, because it's, as I said, dystopian future after a limited nuclear exchange with an ongoing conflict between Western Bloc and Eastern Bloc. And that was felt to be too raw to be calling it 1948. I'd kind of remembered it being published sort of more immediately post-war than that, sort of 46, that sort of time, but I could be wrong on that. I have to say, in terms of the DVD production, it is as brilliant as you would expect from the BFI. There are really interesting extras, interviews, footage from the time. I think the one thing that would really make it, and I think is a missed opportunity, is that about 10 years later, so mid-60s, there was a second BBC production of 1984 in the Theatre 625 Strand.
65, November 65 it was, according to Wikipedia.
And that was a lost episode. And that has been recovered from the American Library of Congress. There was a big chunk of predominantly BBC material came back from the American Library of Congress. And that version of 1984 was in that. And it would have been nice to have that on the set as well.
But this version is beautifully cleaned up. Really couldn't expect something better as a 1954 or five-line telerecording. What they've done, the film inserts are
absolutely beautiful. It looks amazing. I think the thing that absolutely makes it is the performances of the three leads. André Morel, Peter Cushing, woman that played Vashti in The Machine Stops.
Yvonne Mitchell.
I'd got as far as Yvonne Churchman, but...
It's Anne Churchman, yeah, Yvonne Mitchell. The Wikipedia entry is, I've got to say, it's fascinating for this. There's a lot of minutiae in there. The broadcast history, 12th of December 1954, live, not recorded. 12th of December 1954, live, exists as the 35mm telerecording that we've got now. There was, as Simon's just said, the 28th of November 1965, a new production based on this script. The 54 version was repeated August 1977 and July 1994 to commemorate the death of Rudolf Cartier, and again on BBC Four in 2003. So it's been on TV quite a bit. But this remastered version, yeah, I know that you've been waiting a long time because you didn't want, we've always planned to do this as episode 101, but you didn't want to do this until the BFI version came out.
Yeah, because I've had a rip of it for years and years and years, so I've seen this before, but it's like we waited for Quatermass in the Pit until the Blue.
I'm so glad we did.
Yeah, the same with this, and I'm really glad we waited because it looks beautiful.
There was actually a proposed repeat as part of the BBC's 50th anniversary of television in 1986. That was overruled by the producers of the 1984 John Hurt Richard Burton feature film, who felt that earlier versions would affect the income.
So why did they have a say in what the BBC did?
I do not know. That bit is missing.
And it is very much a, oh, we've seen how this should have been done and we don't want other people to see it admission, isn't it?
Oh, well, further to what you've just said about the Library of Congress, Horde, that is in, there's a bit in there about the 1965 version. Long believed lost. On the 12th of September 2010, it was announced that a copy had been located at the American Library of Congress, although an approximately 7-minute segment in the middle was unrecoverable from the NTSC videotape recording. It was recovered amongst a hoard of over 80 lost British TV episodes dating from 1957 to 1970. And in 1965, a radio adaptation was broadcast on the BBC Home Service with Patrick Troughton.
As which character?
I don't know.
And does it exist?
I don't know. But this we now must research this. Because we're really good at research here at EME. Not to play this down at all or skim around the plot, but the plot itself, it is fairly thin. It's more a painting a picture of what a dystopian future could look like. I'd like to say that it's a really bleak picture. It is a really bleak picture, but it's not unthinkable. The big brother watching you sort of thing and everything that you do is analysed and recorded somewhere and overheard. It's not a million miles from the truth now.
And in terms of realism, it's kind of the flip side of Year of the Sex Olympics.
I'll take your word for that until I've actually seen the thing. But in terms of, you know, being listened in on, I know that there's a station at Blubberhouses that monitors every single text message that's sent in the country. And, you know, even boiling it down to things like Amazon, Facebook will show you adverts for things that you've, you know, you've messaged your friends about on WhatsApp, or you've watched TikToks about, or you've looked at on Twitter. All of a sudden, things will start appearing as suggested items that you might like to buy on your Facebook timeline. They know stuff. They know everything that we do. Anybody that's out there that thinks that I'm not doing this because I don't want them to know, they already know, Carg. They know more about you than you do.
And that has been true for our entire lives.
Yes.
It's more obvious now because it's monetized now, but I mean, it's been going on for longer than you and I have been alive.
Oh, entirely. And anyone that thinks otherwise, you're deluding yourself. We're apparently caught on camera about 100 times a day on various...
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's impossible to take yourself off the grid. You can do, and it happens more in America than here, I suspect. But you have to really work at it. That's going and throwing your phone away, nothing electronic, and going living on a remote Scottish island. And, you know, if
you're that paranoid about it, go and do it. But I don't live in fear for my life.
Yeah, people tweeting on their iPhone about how they're taking themselves off the grid kind of need to take a look at their attitudes. It's sort of, yes, of course you are.
There are some very interesting things postulated within the 1984. I'm familiar with the novel. I've seen clips of the 1984 movie, but I've never seen
it. It's not great.
Is it not?
Despite the fact that it's got John Hurt in, it's not great.
Because I've certainly seen at least a clip of the rat scene. If you don't know what the rat scene is in 1984, yeah, that's fairly unpleasant in the book.
Yeah.
And it's something they could never have got away with remotely on television in 1954, and yet.
And so they do it brilliantly. It's an unseen horror, which, to my mind, always works so much more memorably than any amount of
visual effects
and gore and things. I mean, I'm fairly immune to gore because I've stood and got bored in operating theatres, and I've seen as much gore as you can throw around.
Yeah, well, you and I differ on this, but the way that they did it, it was equally unpleasant, actually.
Absolutely. What it reminded me of a lot, I know you haven't seen it, but there is a sequence in the first series of Spooks. That people still talk about, with Lisa Faulkner's character and her death scene where she gets her hand shoved into a chip fryer, and you don't see anything. Gets her hand pushed in, and then she gets her face pushed in, and then she slumps to the floor and she's shot. You don't see anything. It is all off camera and done through acting performances and implied, and it is utterly chilling, and people still talk about it now. And it's one of those false memory things where people are convinced that they've seen something horrific because of how well it was staged and how well it was acted. The Room 101 sequence in this, not quite as blatant, but every bit as effective without actually showing anything horrific.
Oh, yeah, there's not the vaguest whisper of any violence. It's just, this is what we are going to do to you and what will happen to you. And
it's completely sold by Peter Cushing's performance.
Oh.
By itself, pain is not always enough. Here in Room 101, you are meeting the unendurable. You'll do what is required of you.
What is it? How can I do it when I don't know what it is?
You will find, as you know, this is a mask. It fits over the head, leaving no exit. When the plastic door is raised up, the rats will shoot out like bullets. It was a common punishment in Imperial China. The rats were caught in the sewers a week ago. Now they're starving.
No, don't you do it. It's Julia! Not me! Julia! I don't care what you do to her! It's Julia! Julia, not me! Not me!
You see, Peter Cushing, I've got to give well, he's Peter Cushing, for God's sake.
But it's all three of them. If any of those leads were a weak link, it wouldn't work. They're brilliant. Andre Morel is so chilling as O'Brien.
This is one of the best pieces of TV we've ever watched. To skim ahead, it's fairly, I don't think it's giving much away for even those who aren't familiar with 1984 to say that any dystopian future film, series, whatever, is going to end fairly much in disaster. It's going to get unpleasant at some point, and this is no different. Peter Cushing, towards, he starts off for the vast majority of the piece. He's as immaculate as Peter Cushing is. He's sort of Grand Moff Tarkin for most of it. He's very well-groomed. And then at the end, when he gets taken to Room 101 and put through the mincer, He emerges looking about 30 or 40 years older.
Yeah, he looks a shadow of himself and...
He's taken his false teeth out. So he's obviously got half a palate of false teeth because he's taken half of them out to imply that, you know, he's been given a good going over. What an actor. How many actors would do that now?
And that final scene where Smith and Julia meet again after they've both been taken away and interrogated and broken.
Oh, dear.
Heartbreaking.
This couple that have fallen completely head over heels in love, despite all the edicts from them above who forbid relationships and that's just not the way society moves forward anymore and the concept of family has been erased, they fall in love regardless and have this relationship in secret and then they're taken away and conditioned and broken and brainwashed and they meet again in the cafe and it's like they're complete strangers. There's nothing... No, it was all a fantasy and illusion. And they're both broken. Shells.
Absolutely broken.
And the performances, like you say, are spellbinding.
Yeah.
Completely convincing. And what they were before, they're nothing. They're the makeup, the direction, the acting. They're completely different characters. I just can't picture anybody doing that. Now, there's no one that...
I'm doing that live.
Live?
Okay, the sequence where Smith comes out of room 101 and there's that bit where he sees himself in the mirror, that was a pre-record.
Yes, there's a lot of film pre-recording in this, but it's... I'd say it is seamless. It's not like it jars horribly, even though there's... I mean, the one thing I will say is there's a very distinct drop in quality between the live video feed and the filmed inserts, largely because the BFI have cleaned them up to such a high degree. I mean, these are 4K scans of a 35mm film. They're always going to look absolutely pristine. I mean,
they look amazing.
They do look amazing, which unfortunately puts the 405 line segments... A little bit to shame. They are still very, very good.
We saw that with Quest Master Pit as well.
Yeah. It's no slight. There's only so much they can do. You know, you're talking 70-year-old TV. 70 years near enough. Good grief. So, yeah, I'm prepared to be very, very forgiving of it, but what a presentation.
But we don't need to be forgiving of anything. It's, I mean, we watched this separately in preparation for this, and... I remember you messaging me after you'd seen it in absolute awe of what you'd seen.
Well, I got my notebook out. When we record separately, it's just best to take notes. And I put 1984 at the top of the page, and that was it. I was sat just absolutely spellbound for an hour and a half, or however long it was. I didn't want to interrupt what I was watching. And the fact that you get the complete 1954 experience, because there's the introduction from the head of drama, and that goes on for a good 5 minutes, possibly a little longer, warning you about what you're about to see.
But also telling you their thought processes in repeating and why they felt that this was important.
Last Sunday before the play, we gave a warning suggesting perhaps that you might not wish some members of your family circle to watch this piece. But so much has happened since then, so much has been written and so much said, there's little more I need add. We have heard words like disgusting and immoral used. Well, the play is none of these things, but it is grim, frightening, and at times shocking. Shocking in the sense that we are all shocked when we are brought face to face with a picture of man's inhumanity to man, or worse, his inhumanity to the spirit of man. Now tonight,
but in the middle, there's the interval, and that's presented complete, not edited. So you're getting the 1954 experience, what it would have been like on the television. And I'd not thought about it for a long time, that there used to be intervals and things like that for people to get up and have a wee and make a cup of tea and things. And I really liked the fact that that was still in there. The BFI have done a really, really good job on this release. I cannot fault them at all. For the state that some of these things are in and the way that they are presented to them, I've eulogised, as you have, about Network and the stuff that they put out and the quality of the releases that they put out for stuff that's fairly niche. The BFI, when they get hold of something, they really get hold of something and do it as far as they possibly can. Was it Out of the Out of This World?
Out of This World, Little Lost Robot. That was beautifully done.
That was one episode and an audio record, or a couple of audio recordings. And you get this really polished release for something that has got to be a niche audience. We are so lucky to have the BFI.
And Network.
Oh, I'm both, yes.
I know this isn't a network release, but every opportunity we can, shout out to network, because
we wouldn't
have a podcast.
Well, we wouldn't have a podcast with a lot of the stuff that we've done. But the love, this is really a love letter, not only to this production, but to Archive TV in general. This is the second of three editions that we're doing on Nigel Neal. But I stand by everything that I say, that we are so lucky to have what we've got in 2022. The way that things are restored, the way that things are presented, they are not just like they were many, many years ago, spanked out on VHS as they were in the archive. And we've got restoration techniques now that put things out to us in a format that's better than it was when it originally went out. We are very, very lucky. I just look forward to the day when the complete archive of everything is available at the click of a button. We're not there yet, but what we are getting, what is produced and what is given to us and what is sold to us, for all those that complain, well, I've already paid for this once, why should I pay for it again? Well, don't pay for it then. But I am happy to part with money for the releases that are put out at the quality that they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And as fans, it's easy to focus on the negative and say, we don't have 97 episodes of Doctor Who. We don't have the majority of season one Avengers. We don't have four episodes of Quatermass Experiment.
As we all know, there will always be 97 missing episodes of Doctor Who.
Please, Ian Levine, just say it. Just say it. And it's easy to focus on that rather than focusing on just how much good stuff we do have and how we have things like the BFI. Not just putting out superb quality DVDs like that, like this, but they do live events.
Yeah, yes.
Have you been to any of their live events?
Unfortunately not, but they always, there's a big stir within the community. We should do an EME on tour, really. It's just this love of archive stuff that the vast, vast majority of people won't give a shit. But for the people that do, and I'm firmly, after being years of being a Doctor Who fan, I am now a dedicated archivist. I never want anything to be lost, for good or ill. But the preservation that's going on from the BFI and other people, like, you know, organisations like Kaleidoscope, for example, actively out there looking for lost material, no matter
and
what it is.
Individuals as well.
Oh, yes, but as a collective, I mean. Yeah. Kaleidoscope, really, I look as a bringing together of like-minded individuals rather than just being Kaleidoscope, because there's a Facebook group. People will turn up and say, you know, I found a copy of TVAM from 1983 on an old VHS I found. Anyone interested? And yes, absolutely. Or there's the whole TVS archive is missing. You know, we found a... Something turned up the other day and it was something ridiculous. It was a sitcom featuring Lisa Goddard that had been out on YouTube for years and nobody had even known that it was missing or out there. It was right there in plain sight, but even though it's not of value to the vast majority of people, it's still there as a record. And I am so glad that the community is out there looking for stuff that is piecing together how things, you know, used to be. There's stuff that we'd never make today. Topics that we'd never address today, sitcoms, comedy, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Production techniques that we don't use anymore. It's a good archive of televisional history.
Yeah, and we saw that when we saw the redone Quatermass Experiment. The BBC doesn't know how to make live drama anymore.
No.
And they are acting skills that came from theatre. They are directorial skills that came from theatre and having to do seat of your pants stuff as a live TV director. All of these skill sets have been lost. Now, they've been replaced with much more nuanced, naturalistic performances in a lot of things. The directorial skills is a more filmic type of thing. None of this is bad, but we've lost that classic TV experience that you get with things like 1984, and we're all about the classic here at EME.
It is true, and I've said this many times before, for all your... David Tennant is the one that leaps to mind. If you look at certainly David Tennant, Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi, they've got an acting style that's very rapid fire in your face. It's very naturalistic. You can believe in their performance, whatever they're doing. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch, I'm a big fan of his work. No matter what he's been in, he's always been brilliant.
Yeah. And but they are, all I criticise Sherlock, I have no criticism of his portrayal of Sherlock. It's really the
writing that you've got. We must come on. We must do Sherlock Holmes at some point. But yes, we will. I've endured Corridor People for you. You need to take a hit for me. But for all those performances, and let's be honest, the vast majority of actors nowadays are not that level. We look back at stuff that's primarily 60s and 70s. I have got to say my leaning is more towards the 60s because it is all those theatre actors. And there's a very crisp, measured delivery and it's performed. It's not just...
But you do get some crap performances in the 60s.
Of course. We have seen many, many of those over the years. And
many, many times.
Many, many times. Many, many times.
What I was thinking of is when we did It's Dark Outside and the religious cult leader.
Oh, God.
I loved her, you know. I did.
Oh, my. Yes, yeah, so not everything old is wonderful. I'll counter that. But... A lot of the archive TV we watch is old theatre actors. It's a very, very different style.
It has an immediacy to it.
Mm. And I'm very, very fond of it. So for all that I will happily heap praise on modern performances when they are naturalistic and rapid fire and really vibrant, there's just something about that crisp, clean delivery from people like Peter Cushing. They've got a real charm and a powerful... gravitas behind them that you don't get now.
And if you want to see and experience how that kind of television is, well, I mean, if you don't know how that kind of television is, why on earth are you listening to us? But somebody who smelt the gin wandered in and decided to stick around for the smutty jokes. Hello.
That should be our tagline, smell the gin and wander in. Welcome to the Exton Moss experiment.
Splishy, splishy.
Yes, that's our new tagline.
But this is a brilliant example of just how spellbinding live TV could be.
For the age of the, like I say, 70 years, for the age of this, absolutely magnificent. And I'm so glad Peter Cushing was effectively the lead. I know there were three, but Peter Cushing carries it for the most part, and he's absolutely marvellous.
I think we have a couple of people that we need to hear from.
It does fall into the category, Paula. Which of the important characters would you like to talk to?
Professor Quatermass's office. He's speaking. Is it something bad?
How many are we giving the RPometer?
Four.
Yes, it's not quite. I don't think anything's going to beat Paula, is it?
Well, the Windsors. Constitutional crassass.
Crassass. Fofter. Yes, I will give it a 4-2. Yep. It's RP wise, we are very much in the darkest heart of BBC RP when everybody had to speak in a certain way.
Daddy.
Ding me back a nut from the war. I will, darling. Yes, I will. Kiss the children for me.
Something for the mantletops.
Pour me a brandy, darling. It might be the last one we have together. So, yeah, 4 out of 5 for that. But we have someone else to hear from.
Well, as this is kind of a special commentary episode, we should probably hear from our...
Any old fucking crowbar. Get her out. Come on, Siri.
I am Persian. Name your price.
This is wildly inappropriate. How drag queeny is 1984?
It isn't really. They're all in overalls, apart from that frock that Yvonne Mitchell puts on with the makeup that you can't tell where she's wearing makeup. You know, when they're in that, they're setting up home together that flat above the shop before they're discovered, and she makes a big thing about getting hold of this old frock. Now, that old frock is a bit flancy and drag queeny, but it's still a 2.
Got the crowbar out there, lad. Yes. I'm just going to hand over the reins for this segment. I have no idea. After all this time, I still don't get drag queens. It's just beyond my ken. So as somebody who is uninitiated and doesn't know a thing about it, I am going to shut my cake hole and sign us off. But thank you for listening to us. Go out and buy this. Go out and buy it. It's a really, really... If you've got the vaguest interest in archive TV... which you should, as Simon says, if you're listening to us, go out and buy this on Blu-ray. It is absolutely magnificent. What a slice of TV from 1954.
And while you're on the BFI website, get hold of the Year of the Sex Olympics as well, because it is another Nigel Neal dystopian future, but from a completely different perspective.
So you can have a knockabout romp watch along with us, but we'll be back very soon. Thank you as ever, boys and girls. Ta-ta.
Bye-bye.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.